This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location in Boston with Oscold Melnichuk, and I am Grace Cavalieri. And Oscold has premiered, he's premiering right this minute, 50 years of poetry in one collection. And this is traditions, customs, myths, legends. It has so much. Tell us the title of the book and what you think is in it. How do you describe it?
So the title is The Venus of Odessa. And in fact, this is what it looks like, the cover of the book. The Venus of Odessa, however, it looks very different. The Venus of Odessa is what I named a figurine I found when I was visiting the Archaeological Museum in Odessa, Ukraine, some 20 years ago. The figurine looks like this, a clay figure known as the Polovtsian Baba, who reminded me so much of the Venus of Willendorf that I simply relabeled her the Venus of Odessa. And the collection, is a kind of surprise at this stage in life and in my literary career. I'm very grateful to the publisher, Mark Vincenz, from Mad Hat Press, who accepted this book a couple of years ago. I had begun as a poet and then began to write and publish fiction and began to put my energies into that. In the meantime, I did keep writing poems all along the way and kind of gathered them up and would periodically, send it out and it would come back. And then I would wait a few years and try again. And as it happened, I found the right editor at the right moment.
50 years worth, 50 years in one volume. And let us hear an opening poem from Venus of Odessa. Let's hear it.
So this is actually the first poem in the book, and it's one of my earliest published poems. It appeared in the Village Voice in 1974. It's called The Dance of the Tomahawks, and the Tomahawks were a Brooklyn street gang active in the 70s. Dance of the Tomahawks. The tomahawks are pushing ice picks through my teeth. I'm seeing stars. I think my luck is changing for the better. Snap of sinews, knee to chest, toe to groin. How long I've longed to bleed internally. Lying flat on this dark street, I watch the young chief rub his hands together. He is thinking of his mother, whose hair he wears, whose eyes he has. He falls to his knees, roots them firmly in my pelvic cushion and raises his hands to the sky. His hot tears mingle with mine like a garland, and we know we are brothers, one soul continually searching, each in his manner, each in his manner.
He's thinking of his mother, the voice of Oscold Melnichuk. Now, Oscold has published four novels, a book of short stories, and a novella about the life of Rimbaud. And What Is Told is the New York Times notable book, the first commercially published book about the Ukrainian refugees. But today you are our poet. And so we know that your DNA is in Ukraine, although you live in America. So give the audience a little sense of your lineage about how it is that you are still such an emblem of Ukraine.
Thanks, Grace. My parents were both refugees from Ukraine. They fled the country at nearly the end of the Second World War, in part because my grandfather, a high school teacher in Przemyśl, Poland, was on a communist hit list, and he felt the family had endured enough already so that he did not want to put them through losing him and leaving his children on their own. And so they decided to take up and leave. And, the United States is a haven, or has been in the past, a haven for refugees and immigrants. There are different kinds of refugees and immigrants. There are those who come here seeking economic opportunity, and those many who come here escaping from intolerable, unbearable situations. And they approach their American experience, I think, very differently because of that, a different motivation. Those who come here because they're fleeing unbearable circumstances often wind up pining and longing to return home. And that was very much the case with both my parents, who ex fully expected that they would one day be able to head back to their native Ukraine. As that did not ha as decades went by, that did not happen. They more than reconciled themselves to life in this country. They came to love it. They came to believe in it. They came to believe in the importance of the values that it represented, particularly the value of free speech, the value to remain who you were while also respecting the values of the country in which you found yourself. At the same time, their sort of longing for their native land was sort of transmitted to my sister and myself. Ukrainian was our first language. This is what we spoke before going to our entering kindergarten and beginning school. And when you learn a language that young, even though as a kid you're long to assimilate and be one of the crowd, you also recognize later that you have access to something that others don't. And that access to another world offers another perspective on the one in which you find yourself. And you find that you yourself are enriched by encounters with other cultures, with people whose backgrounds are so different from yours. It makes life that much more interesting. And then when you recognize you have access that others don't, you want to share what you have.
And
And
you have, and this is exactly what you've dedicated your life to doing. And this is coming out in your poems, and we would love to hear two from the present book, Oskol Melnichuk.
so this is called The Enamel Box, and it's apropos of our conversation just now. It was it's sort of a poem about a box given my mother by a visitor from Ukraine. It was a country in a house I'd never seen. This trinket, an odd record of humanity. Starfish, pewter, purple, green. Ancestral garden from a greener age. And I turn outward to the oak which spring has, like a famished lover, licked awake. I imagine somewhere beyond the tree, that house, the solitary, careful child within, and the dragonflies rising and falling like pistons above a sputtering stream. The mother breaks bread by an open window, humming softly to a dying son. The father smokes a pipe, instructs the child, cultivate wheat and a conscience. In a pinch, forfeit the conscience, but save that wheat. It jars me, this lecture I've imagined, because there ought to be causes worth dying for, and my peasant says no. Is it the mysteries of Eleusis he's understood, while I, battling each morning uncharitable Aristotle, worry the fine points, obscure to the whole? The old man says to the boy, anyone tells you God cares about anything except kindness is a liar. I imagine a mother, a father, a child, a house. Eternal actors, paramours of joy and pain, except the child, born all eyes, who sits at the window watching the dragonflies and does not know centuries are passing. This is how they pass.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Thank you.
In addition to story, there is everything in this book. It's literary figures, spiritual, philosophical figures. Let us have another.
This is a more recent poem, Chorale in April, and it is based on a photograph of two boys in a stretcher after a bombing in Beirut. One of the boys is likely dead, stretched out, and the other one is sitting up on the stretcher, kind of looking into the camera. Chorale in April. Because pain is colloquial as every true poem. Because I can neither look nor entirely look away from myself. Two Lebanese boys on a stretcher. Fish in a net show more surprise. I listen for words rushing from trees through the April staccato of rain. A finite network of roots wires the earth, and every caress carries for thousands of miles. Bewildering the mouths of the dead, methodically stifling their hunger with flowers. Soon these green fists will open, and the veins of the leaves, hammered daily by light, will swell until the leaves themselves begin to darken, shrivel, fall. The living brother must speak for himself. The rain says nothing at all.
I listen to words rushing through. If you did not write that, who would? The imagery in that really goes through my whole body. That is absolutely breathtaking. And you go beyond the limitations of language. Something much more than language is in that poem. I want everyone to know that you have a volume of your essays, of which we heard a little of your lineage, coming out from Harvard next year in 2026. And that's with Madonna and with Madonna in Kiev. Why
right.
Literature still matters more. Yes. And more than ever, I think you say, you've edited a book of essays on Derek Wolcott, who I think you studied with, and you are co-editor of From These Worlds, an anthology of Ukrainian writers from the 1980s generation. I'm giving all your creds because you've worked in the trenches for since you were a teenager. And so we have a lot to say about you, and we're going to say all of it. But I still want another poem.
Great. So I will read...
Read one or two, whatever we'll take.
This is a poem of, about my father as he was dying. And it's, My Father Has a Vision. A cathedral rose in a pint of yogurt you were spooning. Look, you cried, look. I raced in from the other room, fearing you'd fallen. Look, you cried, what's it doing there? And truly, Father, a gray stone spire probed the air, draped in white silk above the 8-ounce cup, supported by flying buttresses, a rose window, snarling gargoyles spouting fire. It wasn't the morphine. You weren't dying of pain. You saw what you saw. And the pigeons exploded into the room and roosted above your bed. You know, one of the things I just wanted to say that the experience of watching both my parents age and fall ill, my mother getting what medical personnel call dementia, and we prefer to call forgetfulness in our house, was a fascinating experience in reorienting relationships, in that we came to believe that we needed to see people, meet them where they were, and the sorts of memories that remained, the things that were forgotten, were to be respected. It's not that they were less capable, they were simply different and changed by time into beings that wanted us to find new ways to connect with them. Anyway, so that was sort of a poem in
the
which
moment,
to respect that experience that others might call a hallucination. And I say, you know, you saw what you saw.
And you captured it by, with these people, we are in the moment with them every moment, which is as vivid as anything else. And when the pigeons rush in, that's what you tell us, that this
right.
is the real, this is the only moment there is no other, and that the pigeons are the reality. And that is why you are Osgold Melnichuk. And I have so many questions. One is, you had all of these poems for 50 years, and there would be like 3,000 page book, right? If you had,
sure.
So how did you manage to cull through them and choose what you wanted? And so it would say what you wanted it to say. I mean, how did you choose the poems? I mean, this is a well choreographed book where one page follows the other. And that was not an accident. You didn't throw them all up in the air. So how did, what was that like?
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, there were two elements. One is that in one of the things that I love about poetry is the kind of freedom that one has from the demands of narrative fiction, something else that I do. On the other hand, I also understand that books of poetry need to have their own kind of narrative momentum and arc. And so it took a long time sifting through many, many poems to begin to find what that might be. And the reason I read that first poem, The Dance of the Tomahawks, which is a very young person's poem, I think, I say now, is in part, it, at the same time, it expressed the kind of questing spirit, the one soul continually searching. And that gave me a sort of arc, in fact, the idea for an arc, a sense of a search and a quest. And then to bring in the particulars of the quest and the search. There are a series of poems that are largely grounded in the kind of refugee immigrant experience, writing about different aspects of that. That moves in. We move from that into poems about romantic turbulence and unhappy love poems, the sort of struggles of Bohemia. And life among the poets, which is where I've spent most of my life, that becomes its own kind of material world and subject, and then trying to move through that to a sort of more universal, if you will, realm
Yes.
that is not kind of contained by heritage or profession.
Exactly. You go from story, from personal story to a crash course in civilization. You know, philosophers, artists, literary leaders, it all blends in there. And we're going to have another poem from that right now.
Okay, and this is going to actually take us out of the realm of civilization right down to the alleys of America. This is a poem called Alley Cat, and it's actually dedicated to
Oh, my favorite.
the Oh, that's nice. Dedicated to the poet Tom Slay. Alley Cat. You might have liked burning a city had you been human. Mustard coat, mink skin, little Genghis. Bread on thin bones, slop of new money, but loved by your mother who guzzled the afterbirth. You wasted your youth on squirrels, dreamed of roadkill, sparrows reamed on a spit, knowing by hurt what happens when a creature crosses a road at just the wrong moment. You duck any friend. You might have blinded a giant, loved a dark goddess, seen men raiding the wallet of a sleeping one-legged man, watched white boys take out the trash and take her and take her. What is the soul of an audience? Instead, sweetness, you found your way here, up these long stairs into these peeling rooms. Books, trizub, figs. Let yourself go to my ministrations. Oh, my little eunuch, my Frank Odalisque. Changed from that monster of kneading, in what filthy corner will you be the day that feathery engine finally stops?
Will you say that last line again?
In what filthy corner will you be the day that feathery engine finally stops?
All those F's. You know, to have honored an alley cat with the most lyrical cadence, one can float on every one of those phrases. This is, a cat has never been treated better. I just absolutely think to take that, an alley cat, and to make it immortal with such elegant language, that is, it makes me get up in the morning. It makes me
Thank
know
you so
why
much
we're
for
all
that.
here, why we're bothering, really. You know, at the dinner table last night, you were the subject of our conversation.
Oh no, poor
Oh,
you.
yes. And one person said that it's interesting, they used to consider the words the Ukraine, now called Ukraine. Talk about the difference that article makes. It certainly does. It takes it away from an appendage, doesn't it, to sovereignty? One article.
Well, but you've already said it beautifully, Grace. I couldn't say it better myself. Personally, again, given all the actual real concerns, I have never been terribly obsessed about such matters. I never thought that there was any offense to calling Holland the Netherlands either. But many people did for precisely the reason that you suggested, that it suggested something that was kind of part of something else. It's like the countryside.
Like beyond the
And
pale.
right beyond
You
the
see,
pale,
so I have such smart dinner guests. And another one said, who's also smart, that Ukraine is known for having far better culture than Russia. Because I guess because of freedom of
Well,
the art.
I certainly think there's no doubt that the intellectual and literary scene in contemporary Ukraine far outstrips what is possible in Russia, and that's truly tragic. One of the things that makes it such a sort of a country that's so devoted to literature. In fact, I heard a writer speaking at Harvard a couple of months ago say that. Culture has become a kind of cult there, that even during the bombings, there are hundreds of people showing up for readings in subways, in basements. And, it's in part, though, because of one figure, a 19th century poet, to whom there is actually a statue in your home city, in Washington, D.C. The poet's name is Taras Shevchenko, and he was born a peasant, a serf, owned by a guy named Engelhardt. And he turned out to be a very talented artist. And his owner, I mean, really, it could be serfs were slaves essentially. His owner noticed his talent and sent him to Petersburg to be educated. And there, his sort of artistic community, including some of the most sort of famous Russian and Ukrainian painters of the time, just really admired his work. And so they actually raised money by one painter painting a portrait of the Tsar and selling it, and they bought his freedom. What he did with his freedom is he began to tell the story of the peasants, of the people in their language, which happened to be Ukrainian, different from Russian. And by telling the story of their struggles, their longings, he humanized them and gave them something to reflect on. He told their story for the first time. And because of that, the power of poetry has always been really kind of held up and revered.
What a story. What a fabulous story. Well, you've done a bit of humanizing yourself, and your work has been noted for that. And I want everyone to know it's been in the New Yorker, the Paris Review. You've had the Lila Wallace Award, the George Garrett Award. You've had awards from the Massachusetts Cultural Council in fiction and poetry and nonfiction. I guess you bled that council. And your work has appeared everywhere. We're going to get to all the magazines you founded after the next poem.
So this next poem is also to a friend, the poet Lucy Brock-Boydo, and it's a portrait of Lucy at Stop and Shop.
May she rest.
May she rest. Hesitant high heels tottering, nimble-nosed fawn on an errand for her mother, who once nipped her hind for burrs, then urged her, go. Go to the people's temple to testify that everybody's lost. The lambs are led to slaughter by a shepherd who's insane. Oh, my dear, so what if your fluorescent hair has not been cut this century? Grow into one of us, I urged. You smiled. I'd rather die than did.
Well, we know what you love by what you write. So keep going. You know, going back to Tom Slay, I thought you dedicated that poem to T.S. Eliot.
Oh, cats, right. There would have
Because it
been
was TS.
right.
Okay, back to poetry. Have another one?
This is actually a love poem, and it's dedicated to my wife Alex, Alexandra Johnson, a writer. All talk is moths. I nestled among pines beside a toad whose journey I interrupted, and curled my arms around my legs and stared at the trees. Then I took out a thermos and poured a cup of coffee. A moth fell in, and it was too late to save it. Twilight, you deepening around me. Not that I forgot debts to society or friends and the usurious interest we pay. Not that I forgot hearts mangled like syntax by strangers, or years speaking only in fragments. But here I was, anyway, drinking a moth's wing, happy past speech.
Happy past speech. I happen to know how old you were when you started Acme Review. Like a young boy sitting in the middle of Massachusetts Avenue singing. Now, what you started, you must have known in the cradle that you were going to produce, present, write, and publish and further other writers. You must have been in the crib and had a vision because you started pretty early, didn't you? I mean, the Acme Review, you must have been what, 20?
It actually began as an underground newspaper in high school.
Oh, there we go.
I had the good fortune to come of age at a time when we, the people, were beginning to recognize our power and our independence and possibility. And technologies were making it possible for those of us with humble means to find ways to communicate with the outside world. So, in fact, I was in Cranford High School in New Jersey. I was the editorial page editor for our high school paper. And an editorial I'd written about something, God knows, something that was of great relevance to all of us in high school that might sound silly now, was censored by the principal or vice principal, whoever. And we, instead of taking that lying down, a group of us decided that we were going to create a vehicle that would allow us to speak truth to power, as the phrase went back in those days, and say what we believe we needed to say. And four or five of us began to put out this mimeographed magazine. It was the time of zines, right? At the very start of that whole sort of underground press movement. And high school students all around the country and college students were beginning to put out their own little journals and, stapled, mimeographed. You could buy a mimeograph machine for $35 and crank this stuff out in your attic or a garage or your room. And then we would distribute them to our fellow high school students, or sell them for a penny on the corner, and get into all kinds of trouble, but also be taken seriously, as it turned out, by the authorities, because out of that newspaper we got a meeting with the Board of Education and began to present student demands to them. And one realized that one had a voice and one could create a vehicle for it.
Oh, we must tell that what it has become is one of the most sought after literary magazines in America to be published in.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that you stick with anything long enough and it has a chance in this world to prove itself. And it was always also a matter of luck, of crossing paths with young writers starting out whose voices you felt needed to have a place. And at the same time, it was also one of the strategies that I remember sort of deploying so deliberately in developing Anyi was writing to writers whose work I'd begun reading and respected, and discovering that they actually wrote back and sent poems. So I wrote to Lawrence Ferlinghetti in high school,
Yes,
and he wrote back.
of
Amazing.
course, of course. That is, and now Aerosmith.
Aerosmith too was sort of started on the fly because a friend from Ukraine, from Kyiv, their really kind of best known poet and fiction writer, a woman named Oksana Zabushko, was coming to a Pan International conference in New York City, one spring, and she was going to be on a panel with, I think it was Bernard, the French philosopher Bernard Henri Lévy, and a number of other really well-known, sort of internationally known figures. And she had nothing available in English in print in the United States. And so I translated a long story of hers, and with the help of an undergraduate student at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, managed to print up copies. And I had left Agni in 2001 because I was tired of waking up 10,000 pages behind in my reading every day, which is what happens when you edit a literary magazine. And so I decided, so I decided to take a break from publishing, and then this sort of triggered, rekindled an appetite. And we've now published some 70 books, including
Yes.
books by National Book Critics Circle Award winners and Pulitzer Prize
And
winners,
as if I
unknown
may use
writers.
the word chic, it is cutting edge. It is the top of the 12-foot surf. It is really at the top of the game. And all the voices are so original, so fresh. It's such new writing. But let's hear some of your writing again. Give us two.
Okay. So this is a poem called La Bohème. And this is based on Puccini's opera. Mimi, whose svelte hands Rodolfo lipped so hungrily last week, can't climb the stairs, and anyway, her cough might break his epic concentration on the work where all will be revealed, heart and more laid bare. God pulls snorting toward the pasture of the page. Then she's dying. Death's homely spirit wakens something human in her friends. Musetta prays. Rodolfo hopes they'll waltz again. Then, of course, she's dead. Rodolfo cries out, "Me, me!" How every word reveals us. You begin with animal spirits and a gift. These you spoil early. You begin with something luminous, soon lulled into a little stupor. Consider Montegatto, who skins cats for stews in stylish kitchens. Stanky, harvester of dog shit, breeding worms under his bed. Sweet Yvette, betrayed by love, who wedges into life by peddling lemon peels for oils and scents that stimulate the semi-celibate Baudelaire, brooding, catatonic, in a louse-laced attic, on a dream in which he's sailing, and although he's broke and at her mercy, nailed to the prow's his mother's head. It is the voyage of a sailor damned to scudding seas aboard a schooner in a bottle, where the rigging's spider-sized. Boat that's whipped and shaken by no tempest but the senses and the shapeless self, which slips one dawn into a harbor where a woman rises from the water like a Cytherean goddess. And the shore is thick with anxious men. And finally, I thought I'd read the last poem in the book, which is also the title poem, The Venus of Odessa. And I mentioned earlier what I showed earlier, the figurine that it's based on. This is my inspiration. The Venus of Odessa. Transfixed, obedient gray clay, imperfectly glazed. Utterly sated at last. The future of the world once burned under your lids. Never, woman, no man's, will you find another to love you as he did, does. Love being a lifelong, deathlong conversation. Loves you as a god might love the river where I walk, millennia or days gone by like water. Does the water know? That's how it sometimes is, particular, disinterested, and friendly to the geese. And nothing careless in the taste of air on clay or tongue. The idiocy of blood and ideology of bone don't fool you now. I hold you at arm's length, I touch you with my thumb. I hope the flesh this was knew every crevice, every rain. And did it know how far a man may go to raise his father's house, crawl home? I just want to point out that the word raise at the very end is not raise as in build up, but raise as in RAZE, tear down his father's
Oh,
house,
yeah.
call home.
Everything we need is in that poem. That poem, why does it make me cry? What do you think is in that poem? Even though you wrote it, I don't know if you understand. There, everything we know about loss and love, it just is so visceral for me. What did it mean to write that poem?
Thank you, Grace. Thank you for all that. It was a strange poem because, as you know, I think you suggest, I'm not sure that I understand every turn that it takes, but it was trying to find language that somehow, you look at a little sculpture like this and you can make nothing of it or you can make everything of it.
Ah, there you go. That
And
is everything. You've said it all. You've given the definition of poetry. You can make nothing of it or make everything of it, and you really did. Do you have another poem you'd like to leave us with?
Sure.
I'll tell them that you received the Penn Award for editing, and you've taught at Boston University, Harvard, Bennington, and now you're at the University of Massachusetts, as we say. And I think you go to class tomorrow.
Indeed, I do, and I'm really looking forward to it because
Oh, that's great.
the students are terrific
That is
and
so good to
Olympia
hear.
Young. This is an anticipation of the unfolding of the seasons, and all we have to look forward to as we prepare for what's coming. And this is a little out of season for today, but we'll do it. After a snowfall, the second day of spring, and this is for Gus and Aiko. What else are we here for? The unfinished lives, the garages uncleaned, love letters unsent, filled with complaints. Arguments with a mysteriously missing beloved who knows why she's here no better than we. The projects half started, novels and plays, the efforts at politics, the partial despair at how close we come before falling. The friendships that promised deliverance and maybe come nearest of all to delivering what they promised. The unvisited cities, the grackles unseen in our yards, the secret life of the soil glimpsed only on television, the planets dismissed with a shrug and some lies about science, parents unknown, the mothers and fathers mysterious in their own homes and to each other, the endless talks with ourselves, and no answers, just stutters. Then spring.
The voice of Oskold Melnicek, and this is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Snippet Fund, the Rabada Foundation of the Logan Family, and friends of the program, Natalie Canivore and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin is our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.